Case number 20-7040, Brody Capital Management LLC and Elliot Brody versus Nicholas D. Muzin et al. Appellants. Mr. Obermeyer for the appellants, Mr. Coffin for the appellees.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Obermeyer, you may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Steve Obermeyer, and I represent appellants Nicholas Muzin and Stonington Strategies, LLC. I'm also arguing today on behalf of appellants Joseph Allaham and Gregory Howard. This case challenges the legality of diplomatic decisions made by the foreign sovereign state of Qatar. The Ninth Circuit has now held that Qatar is entitled to immunity for the exact same wrongful conduct that is alleged in this case.
But Mr. Obermeyer, Qatar's not a party here, and there's no evidence that the defendants in this case were employed by Qatar or that Qatar chose them as its agents here. In fact, I'm not even sure why you have a right to appeal given those facts. Can you first address our appellate jurisdiction?
Yes, I'd be happy to, Your Honor. First of all, what's been alleged is that appellants are agents of Qatar acting at the direction of Qatar. The whole theory of Mr. Brody's case is that Qatar decided to do, not to target Mr. Brody, but to do a hacking and dissemination scheme, which he directed appellants to do. Those are the allegations in the complaint. So the absence of evidence at this point, I don't think is an issue, because that's what Mr. Brody says happened. He pled himself into that.
We, in subject matter jurisdiction, we don't always just go on the pleadings. And the record suggests the lack of even a formal agency relationship between defendants and Qatar. The contract that was in the record said that the embassy doesn't acknowledge these people as their agents.
Well, the contract in the record, Your Honors, says that appellants were hired to do various lobbying and diplomatic work on behalf of Qatar. And then Mr. Brody goes farther and alleges that appellants were directed to conspire to hack and then distribute materials from the hack in order to advance its political agenda against Mr. Brody.
I'm reading from Mr. Muzin's opening brief on the motion to dismiss, which the other briefs incorporated by reference. On page 23, note 11, he says, the Qatari embassy states that it does not establish an agency relationship between Qatar and Stonington. And it cites to an exhibit in the California litigation.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's what the contract says. But what's alleged is that, what's alleged in the case is that the relationship started off doing lobbying and turned into, I don't know the exact word, something worse when Qatar directed appellants to participate in a hacking conspiracy.
Well, you're going to help us out. The complaint alleges you're going to help us out in all these various ways, but it also says, and you're not our agent, by the way.
Well, Your Honor, the contract said that, but the complaint alleges that they are Qatari agents. And I would point you to actually Mr. Brody's own words in his opposition to the interlocutory appeal motion on page 8. He says that appellants were plainly agents for Qatar. And he also says that he alleges that defendants acted at Qatar's direction. He also says in his opposition brief here that Qatar and appellants sought to isolate and marginalize Brody's influence through a tried and true Qatari tactic, an illegal hacking and media distribution. So that's Brody's own characterization of his complaint.
I understand that you're relying on the characterizations in the complaint, but there's something peculiar about basing our jurisdiction on those allegations when we have reason to believe, when we don't have any reason to believe that Qatar has actually sought to assert its immunity for your clients.
Well, I guess a few things, Your Honor. On the jurisdictional point, you know, this court has been clear that foreign sovereign immunity is a collateral order doctrine issue. Conduct-based immunity that is what we're dealing with here is immunity of the foreign sovereign.
So what case do you have where there's interlocutory appellate jurisdiction and there's no foreign state, or in the case of Samantar, putative voice on behalf of a putative sovereign involved in any way?
I'm not sure about the absence of the sovereign in any way, but the cases I'm thinking of are Farhang, I believe it's the Mamani or Mamani decision in the 11th Circuit. Farhang is
Mamani.
Mamani, right?
Farhang is.
I'm sorry. Farhang is in the 9th Circuit, and then also Samantar.
The cases you cited, I thought, were PNID versus Nigeria and Kilburn versus Libya from this court. Those cases both involve sovereigns, you know, suits, claims against sovereigns.
Yes, Your Honor. Specifically, this court, we cite Kilburn, we cite PNID. But those cases, like I said, say that foreign sovereign immunity satisfies the standard for collateral order doctrine. And in conduct-based foreign sovereign immunity is the immunity of the foreign sovereign. So it's our position that that's covered. And the cases I was referring you to from other circuits are cases that have held that conduct-based immunity is immediately appealable under the collateral order doctrine.
Mr. Obermeyer, on this point, you have some burden when it comes to the jurisdiction question here and some burden when it comes to your assertion of immunity. Put aside the complaint and put aside the contract. Do you represent that Muzin was an agent of Qatar?
I don't know that I can represent anything beyond what's been alleged at this point, Your Honor.
Do you represent? So you can't represent that Stonington is an agent of Qatar?
They were acting as contractors for Qatar, sure.
That's not my question.
They registered on you. They registered under FARA as agents of Qatar, yes.
So are you representing that they are agents of Qatar?
They registered under FARA, they are agents of Qatar.
Okay.
And you have not requested an opportunity, if we were to look beyond the pleadings, an opportunity to establish the direction by Qatar in the district court. You never asked for that in the district court.
Your Honor, no, because again, Mr. Brody was his burden to start was to plead an objection to the state's immunity. He pled that the objection comes down to the fact that the agents here are U.S. citizens. He at that point we're operating under the complaint, and Mr. Brody's never really pushed back on that, Your Honor. I believe there was a request for agents for 12B1 discovery, maybe in a footnote at the motion to dismiss stage, but going back to those quotes I read you from his own briefing, he has agreed with us that that is what he's pleading. And that's what
our jurisdiction is not something that the two of you can agree on.
Well,
if there's any waiver here, the waiver is by Qatar, which, I mean, why shouldn't we just hold that, you know, that the immunity emanates in one way or another from Qatar? It never has asserted anything in this case.
Well, Your Honor, this has been something I've been meaning to get to, but we've gotten sidetracked a little bit, but what the Supreme Court said in Samantar is that in the absence of a statement of immunity, like the case here, it's not that the inquiry ends there. It's on the court to look to the established principles of the State Department and the common law to understand the agent's immunity. And that's what we're asking the court to do here. I mean, keep in mind, when the case was initially decided in California a couple of years ago, the court found right away that Qatar was immune. You have the allegations in his own complaint that we're the agents of Qatar. So at that point, you know, from a 12B1 perspective, there's no more to do. I mean, the pleading standard for him at that point is similar to a 12B6 standard. There's been no request for discovery, no further factual development. And that's the record. That's why your jurisdiction, I don't think, is affected by the fact that we're on the complaint.
But Qatar never communicated with the State Department to request a finding of immunity for these defendants, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. But my response to that would be they had the ruling right away that they were immune. They had the allegations that we're acting at their direction. And if you look at the Heaney case from the Second Circuit from Judge Friendly, he says in the absence of a statement of immunity, when you're talking about like the heart of political acts, diplomatic acts like you have here, the court doesn't need a statement of immunity to find jurisdiction.
What diplomatic acts are you talking about?
The ones that the Ninth Circuit said here, that the hacking and distribution of hacked materials, the Ninth Circuit said are diplomatic activities of a sovereign, that the use of irregular operatives to hack an enemy and distribute those materials are, quote, uniquely sovereign.
To the extent they're engaged in by Qatar, but these laws, these statutes and the California law that was alleged are, they all apply also to private individuals who want to go in and hack. And for example, if your clients had done what they did and then turned around and offered their wares to Qatar, there would be no claim of immunity.
I think that's right, Your Honor, but that's not what happened here. I mean, there's no daylight between what Qatar is immune, has been, the Ninth Circuit held Qatar is immune from doing, and what Mr. Broidy alleges we did. The state can only act through its agents. I mean, that's a sort of a fundamental proposition of foreign sovereign immunity that goes back, you know, 200 years. The state can only act through its agents. The agents here, as alleged by Mr. Broidy, are appellants. And so what he's challenging, what a litigation of this case would be a judgment on how Qatar A decided to implement its diplomatic acts, as the Ninth Circuit said, and also it would be an adjudication of Qatar's decision to use U.S. agents to do that.
How would exercising jurisdiction here? How does the district court's order that it wants to exercise jurisdiction here have the effect of enforcing a rule of law against the state of Qatar? I don't see that. If the district court is careful about discovery and respecting Qatar's immunity, it can apply the domestic law to these individuals without any attention to the role of the state.
Well, two things, Your Honor. Respectfully, that standard is from the Restatement 66, which, you know, we contend is not the scope of conduct-based immunity in the common law. So when Lewis is talking about that, for instance, that's under the assumption that Section 66 is the scope of conduct-based immunity common law. So that's not what we're saying. So I want to be clear about that. But in this case, it's still even different than Lewis if you apply that, because in this case, the agents are doing what Qatar has been held to be immune to do. I said that correctly. But the actions that the agents are taking, they are the state when they're doing them, when they're directed by the state. And so this is where you sort of, it's not about the individuals. That's what conduct-based immunity is about, the immunity of the state. And again, that's the fundamental premise.
If you take the allegations as true of the complaint, would you agree with me they make out a criminal offense under federal law?
Honestly, I'm not a criminal lawyer, but it sounds criminal to me.
Yeah. And isn't it also true that an individual committing criminal offenses is not entitled to immunity?
Well, that's true, Your Honor. And in fact,
then doesn't it follow then that if we accept the allegations in the complaint, as you have just agreed, making out a criminal offenses, there's no way that these individuals are entitled to immunity? Because if they were, then I think there's some indictments that have to be dismissed of some Russian hackers that occurred during the previous election, not this one.
Well, I think it's two separate. I'm not sure I'm entirely following, Your Honor, but I think it's two separate things. I mean, what we're saying here is that they are immune for the civil claims in this case. And, you know, what's left are misappropriation of trade secrets, receipt of stolen property, and conspiracy for basically hacking. We're not saying there's immunity from criminal. And in fact, as we said in our briefs, I mean, you know, the executive retains the authority in these cases to basically decide they're not going to recognize immunity here and pursue them criminally.
Why does it make sense if the same action would make out a criminal offense? If they were indicted first and convicted, and then a civil case was brought, there's no possible way they could have immunity.
Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor, but why it makes sense, though, is because this is, you know, you're in the province of the executive here, at least in terms of understanding foreign sovereign immunity. And so when the executive decides we're going to prosecute this case, they're making a judgment on foreign sovereign immunity. What you have here is you have another U.S. citizen, you know, arguably with an agenda of his own, bringing a civil claim against other U.S. citizens. And that is, in that civil liability where the foreign sovereign is at the mercy of an individual bringing a case at the mercy of the courts, that's what is sort of at the heart of foreign sovereign immunity. And yeah,
I'm not asking you now, I have one more question at least. Put aside the jurisdictional question, an appellate jurisdiction. Is it your position that every individual or company, I guess for that matter, that is registered under the Foreign Agents Registration Act has immunity for anything that it does in compliance with the wishes of the particular government that they're representing?
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. I mean, what I'm saying is something narrow. What I'm saying is that
But you said that because two of your clients at least registered under FARA, that shows that they're agents of Qatar.
Well,
and anything they do that Qatar asks them to do comes within the sphere of immunity.
But let me be clear, Your Honor. So I was asked a question by Judge Walker about outside of the complaint, are they agents? Having registered under FARA, they are agents of the foreign sovereign. Their FARA registration is not what we're saying is the scope of the agency for what happened in this case. What we're saying is the narrow point that because they were pled to have done what Qatar directed them, so it's not an issue of discretion, it's what they were directed to do. Those are the same acts that Qatar has been held to be immune, for which Qatar is held to be immune. It has to be that the people, because the foreign sovereign acts through individuals, it has to be that they are immune too. There's no daylight between them and the individuals. And that's not a broad.
I don't follow that. So imagine you have, I mean, I understand the core cases, all the cases with, you know, you can point out the exceptions to me, but most of these cases involve employees or officials of the state. And when we talk about a foreign official sovereign immunity, we're talking about people who have a relationship as the arm of the government that's immune. It's a very different situation you have somebody that's hired to, you know, sketch out a plan and maybe take action, and where, as appears, there's a disclaimer of an agency relationship in the contract. And to say that it's that Qatar would be immune to the extent, you know, assuming for purposes of the jurisdictional question that Qatar would be immune for its action if it did this, it's very different to say that individuals whose relationship to Qatar has only been pleaded and not established are entitled based on that pleading to immunity. So, I don't know of any case that goes nearly that far.
Well, Your Honor, I think, you know, you've got five cases where, and it starts with Butters, and I can go through them all, right? Where the fact that they're contractors, what was key was that they were directed to do what they did, not their status. And I think the issue is that this is not status-based immunity. This is conduct-based immunity. And if you look at the common law, if you look at the State Department has said, if you look at the foreign sources that the State Department incorporates, it's clear that the fact that you're not an official in the sense that you're working under some sort of a status with a foreign government is not where you draw the line here. Agents of the foreign sovereign, those working at their direction, are entitled to that derivative immunity. It's conduct-based immunity as opposed to status. That's why I think thinking about them in terms of, well, you know, those cases involved, you know, officials, that's not conduct-based immunity.
Your best case is Butters?
I think Butters is our best case, yeah. And Mariah, and also, you know, Ivy, Ryshikov, Alakog, but fundamentally it's Butters. And I think Mariah is very helpful too. And to be clear about Mariah, I mean, the individual in that case, he was a former Israeli minister or something of some sort, official of some sort. But in that case, he was acting at the point when he was a US resident barred in New York, you know, I think ahead of a New York hedge fund. And there was being in that case, well, and Mariah cited Butters favorably. And then in the Ben Haim statement of interest, Department of Justice cited Mariah favorably. So I think the principles in Butters are clear going back to case of Sinclair up through, you know, recently Mouton in the Justice Department cited the case of Sinclair and Mouton just a few months ago.
And would you welcome an opportunity to establish as a factual matter in an evidentiary hearing on remand your client's role as agent, as in regard to the conduct alleged here, acting as agents of Qatar?
Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor. I mean, my concern is this is, I think, the sixth complaint filed by Mr. Broidy. I mean, this is what he's pleading. These arguments were raised in California. He hasn't at any point said that we went rogue, that we were doing something outside of Qatar's direction. What he says is we acted at Qatar's direction. And I think it goes to his whole theory doesn't make any sense if we're not acting at Qatar's direction. So I don't know what discovery would do at this point. I mean, I think this record is enough for your jurisdiction.
But Qatar's involvement is not, I mean, he's not going to in the end have to prove Qatar's involvement, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are violations here that have to do with hacking, getting into accounts that you're not supposed to have access to, doing so repeatedly. I mean, none of the law that supports the causes of action in this case require any involvement of any foreign government, right?
But his theory, Your Honor.
I understand his theory.
Yeah, I mean.
He may not get to do the discovery that he hopes to get about Qatar. I mean, people's motivation for suing is separate from what the law requires and what the claim rests on. I mean, you don't have any question that this case could proceed if Qatar tomorrow turned out to have been a fiction and never existed, could it? I mean, maybe Mr. Broidy wouldn't want to bring the case, but you could litigate this entire case if there's no such thing as Qatar in the world, right?
Only if everything about the case as it's been pled six times up until now is totally different.
Well, no. I'm talking about the factual elements that are alleged supporting the claims of violation of law.
I suppose, Your Honor, as a discrete point, but then the whole thing becomes different. It becomes, you know, you have individuals who are doing something on their own to hurt Mr. Broidy, and the entire context of the case, everything about this, it's an entirely different case. The case that you have before you, and this was Mr. Broidy's choice to plead it this way, and to not ask for, 12B1 discovery, is that we were acting at Qatar's direction. So that's the record on appeal. I'm not sure if that affects your jurisdiction or affects the ability to make a decision here. And again, it's not like this is the first time Mr. Broidy's been here, meaning in court with these allegations. He's never at any point said anyone went rogue. In fact, Your Honor, the complaint is one more point. You know, he says after the initial hack, he went to Qatar and said to Qatar, and I could have to get the quote here for you, but can you direct defendants to stop or are they rogue or are there rogue agents? I mean, fundamentally, what this is about is that appellants were acting at Qatar's direction.
And I assume if this is remanded to the district court, that you will be objecting to any and all discovery into the involvement of Qatar.
Well, we didn't really talk about discovery yet, Your Honor, but I mean, I know what's happened so far and what's going to happen in the district court, which is Mr. Broidy will seek invasive discovery about what happened. In California, the way that manifested itself was that there was sort of an agreement to stay away from the parties, but at the time, for instance, Mr. Allaham was not a party. Discovery was taken. Qatar was in that case, of course, but they stepped in to protect under a protective order as highly confidential what the California court later referred to as the diplomatic communications of Qatar. And this was just, you know, one sort of discrete thing. They stepped in to claim immunity or not immunity, I'm sorry, sort of diplomatic privilege over phone records, over other things as well. What's going to happen here is if the case goes forward, Your Honor, I think we said this, it's going to be a document by document, witness by witness, scorched earth, you know, sort of battle over what's Qatar's, what can it protect? And the reason that is, I think, I sort of fundamentally goes back to what I've been saying the whole time is because the case is about Qatar.
You never sought to have the case dismissed for failure to join an indispensable party that could not be joined under Rule 19, did you?
We didn't in this case, Your Honor. It was Qatar requested it in California. and it was denied. And we were relying on the immunity decision here, Your Honor. And if you look at all these cases, I don't see many Rule 19 arguments. I mean, you know, Rule 19 obviously brings in a few other factors, but, you know, fundamentally, you know, also the California court had ruled against that.
Because Cutter was in the California case, so they didn't need to dismiss.
No, it was because even if they were immune, they may be necessary, but they weren't indispensable.
Can I ask a question about a statement you made in the district court that I think does not mean that you've waived the argument you're making, but I want to get some clarification on it. You said, and this is at docket entry 41, page 12, defendants here assert derivative sovereign immunity, not foreign official immunity. And one way to read that is that you're kind of derivative sovereign immunity that Butters talked about, but you're not asserting conduct-based foreign official immunity, like the kind that was at issue in Lewis. Is that what you were saying then?
I think that was in a footnote, right, Your Honor? I don't have it in front of me. I can't remember precisely what we were getting at then, other than Lewis had come out kind of in the middle of things and sort of shaken things up, and we were sort of figuring out where we were. But you know, I would say we have not waived it. The point was merely we were trying to say, you know, we were bringing a derivative sovereign immunity case at that point, you know, and then we've since reacted to Lewis, but I we have not waived it, Your Honor.
Can you just kind of give me a reason why a statement, defendants here are not asserting foreign official immunity, is not a waiver of your argument that you are now asserting foreign official immunity?
Two things, Your Honor. It was in a footnote, and as opposed to the text, and also in the reply, we were very clear that we were asserting under both.
Okay.
Is that because footnotes don't count?
I guess it depends on the footnote, Your Honor. But
you know, Justice Douglas, in a dissent, said that. He said footnotes don't count, complaining about the majority opinion. But he said it in a footnote.
I'm familiar with that as well, Your Honor. The reason I'm hesitant is because I tend to use them as well, so I don't want to, you know, be accused of waiver about that down the road either.
But isn't it also an issue for, in terms of waiver, that the district court did go ahead and address foreign official immunity as well as derivative immunity? So in some sense, those issues are both before us.
Thank you, Your Honor. That's also a very good point. And it was before us, it was before you on that, for that reason as well.
All right.
No further questions.
Further questions?
Not for me.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Obermeyer. We'll give you a couple of minutes on rebuttal, even though we've way exceeded the time.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Coffin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. You can hear me okay?
We have a little muffled, but yes, we can.
See if I can stand closer to this. Okay. Defendants are U.S. citizens and residents who claim two different forms of what they call foreign sovereign immunity for their involvement in this hack and smear scheme against another American on U.S. soil. Now, Judge Pillard, I want to just briefly on jurisdiction. Our argument on jurisdiction is that there is not a substantial public interest in these defendants being heard in this court at this point. And The reason is their entire argument is that there's a substantial interest in protecting Cutter. Cutter is not here. Cutter has not sought relief from the United States. And Cutter has done everything they can to disclaim association with the facts of this case. So it's very hard for me to see how there is a substantial public interest in protecting Cutter in this case, when Cutter has done nothing to protect itself. On the merits,
the collateral order doctrine doesn't look at substantial public interest. It just looks at whether there's an issue that's conclusively determined by the district court that is completely separate from the merits and would be effectively unreviewable on appeal. And yes, it has to be an important issue completely separate from the merits, but we typically, when we're looking at jurisdiction, we assume the party could prevail on its position and determine in that posture. And so if we assume that Mr. Obermeyer prevails on the, why doesn't that just resolve the jurisdictional question?
Well, first, substantial public interest is, with all respect, part of the analysis under Will v. Haddock. What they're saying is they want to avoid the right, they want the right to avoid a trial, but it's a right to avoid a trial that would imperil a substantial public interest. And the reason is that these defendants, these alleged agents of Qatar, private agents of Qatar, there's no substantial public interest in the timing of this appeal. They can bring that issue at the end of the case, and they can be protected if they are correct. They could be protected from liability at that point. But the right to avoid a trial, as opposed to the right to avoid a trial, doesn't imperil a substantial public interest as to these defendants, unlike the state itself, where there may be.
I'm still having trouble following how you're using that. I mean, as I understand it, the explanation about imperiling a substantial public interest is a big basket describing why we have interlocutory appeals in cases involving, say, immunities. And the protection of immunity at a very general level, that is the substantial public interest. We don't look and say, well, what about this case or this case? Is there a substantial public interest?
Well, it's the kind of immunity. It's the kind of immunity, Your Honor. It's the immunity. And yeah, there's a bit of a merits here, but the immunity as to non-public agents of a foreign sovereign. I mean, part of this is simply these guys just don't merit immunity, and it bleeds into the merits in some regard. And of course, we filed a motion to dismiss the appeal to try to avoid the time of the appeal. So in some sense, we are here on the merits, and I'm happy to talk about the merits. I don't want to get too dragged down in jurisdiction because I think the merits are incredibly strong for our side, and you know, I'd like to move to them. But I hope I got my position.
Oh, I think I mean that makes more sense to me. There is always some sort of merits consideration. If somebody, you know, if I'm sued by my neighbor because my tree is overshadowing hers, I can't just say, well, like Italy made me do it and have an interlocutory appeal. So there, you know, you're always looking at some level at the type of merits claim. And that, to me, that makes more sense than looking more specifically at public interest with respect to, you know, the facts of this.
Big picture.
Yeah, that's helpful.
Look, on the merits, Your Honor, this, and I think the parties agree that Samantar and Hoffman, and even going back to Schooner Exchange, the inquiry on the merits is this two-step analysis that Samantar discusses. On step one, whether Qatar, the foreign state, has asked for immunity, they have not. Nor have they, as Mr. Obermeyer said, nor have they gone to the State Department in any way to seek the United States intervention here. As a matter of fact, Judge Pillard, in the Ninth Circuit, or in the Central District of California, the Qatar actually opposed going to the State Department. They said this is a judicial issue, and you don't have to go to the State Department. Early on, we had said, let's ask, and both defendants said, no, you don't have to ask, and you can dismiss that case on other grounds. That the lack of Qatari involvement in this case does frame this case.
Mr. Coffin, I mean, it would be helpful to have you address directly the core of Mr. Obermeyer's contention, which is this is a 12B1. It's a motion to dismiss. It's based on the complaint. The allegations of the complaint again and again talk about the defendants acting at the behest of Qatar. Why don't we take your word for it, on this point, in terms of analyzing the immunity?
the State Department doesn't take it, take just the allegations of the complaint, and this court has never just looked at the allegations of the complaint. But that said, I want to talk about the allegations of the complaint a little bit.
Tell me what your best authorities are when you say the State Department and this court don't just look at the allegations of the complaint.
Well, so this court in I'm going to quote Judge Sentell, which is my favorite thing to do, being a former Judge Sentell clerk. Bellhouse versus Yellen. Bellhouse involved allegations of some official act. This was under the FSIA. Judge Sentell said, we still want to look at the facts. We have an obligation to satisfy ourselves of the facts. So they looked at the question of official action in that case, notwithstanding the allegations of the complaint. And state has said, look, even when the foreign sovereign tells us something is in an official capacity, we're still going to satisfy ourselves of that. And they've said that, Judge, there are a number of briefs where that we filed. We have a supplemental addendum in this case.
Yes.
That has most of the executive. We thought that would be helpful to you here, given that they're not always easy to find. In that addendum, state repeatedly says it's our determination, with the input of the foreign state that matters. As to the allegations of the complaint, we certainly say they are the agents of the foreign sovereign because they're registered under FARA. The question is, did this occur in any official capacity? And I want to back up for a minute, Judge, before I get into that factual question, because the question of is there an established policy of the United States recognizing immunity under the circumstances here? Step two of the Samantar analysis. There is not a single authority that deals with a pure contracting agent. The best case for Mr. Obermeier is in Re Sinclair, the 1797 Attorney General opinion, but that's under a commission. That is a commissioned privateer under a formal commission recognized under international law to give the protection of the state to the commissioned ship and captain who can't be arrested for piracy and the like under international law. When there is no authority for pure contracting agents, the entire body and the scarce body of law that deals with official immunity is just what you said, Judge Pillard. Officials. That is, the vast majority of these cases involve someone who has an employment relationship and even an appointed or an elected relationship with the state. That is usually high-ranking officials, sometimes just employees, but within the formal structure of the government.
Mr. Coffin, I'm sorry to interrupt, but so much is done by governments around the world through contracting that used to be done by employees. And I guess my precise question is, we don't have a State Department statement of interest here. We don't have Qatar coming in and asking for a position, but if we were to say, is the best way to resolve this case to rely on the burden that there hasn't been a showing that there's an established State Department position, but if the State Department wanted to develop one, nothing that we say would foreclose that.
That's right. On the agency point,
right.
I think it would be an arrogation of judicial power, with all due respect to my friends on the bench, to try to fill a gap here. The common law. My favorite quote in all of this case, Judge Randolph, you're not going to be surprised, is your statement in your separate opinion in Lewis, where you say it may be that there is and never has been a common law of foreign official immunity. I think that's right here in two respects. First, the respect that you said, which is there's just not that much law. There's just not enough of a body of law for us to look at and decide what the standards are. But second, and this is really critical, There is no common law in a classic sense of common law judge-made gap filling. What the entire focus of this inquiry is what would state say? What is the State Department's, what is the position of the United States? And Hoffman, going back to 1949, Hoffman says, courts shouldn't be making it up one way or the other. It's just as bad for a court to try to fill a gap where state wouldn't provide immunity as to do the opposite. And so—
So when you refer to common law, you mean State Department common law.
That's what common law is in this limited context. The substantive law that Hoffman says applies here is what would state do, right? And what you're looking for is an established policy. Now, as to agency, there simply aren't established policies that extend immunity to contracting agents. And what I would say is, if you look, go back to Underhill, the Second Circuit's opinion that led to the active state doctrine in the late 1800s, what that court talked about was immunity for the official representatives of the state. What other courts have talked about are acknowledged and embraced agents, are the authorized and ratified acts of those agents. Going back as far as the first statement by the executive branch, the Attorney General 1794 opinion in suits against foreigners, which is at 1 op Attorney General 45. This is the Guadalupe governor case. If the seizure of a vessel by the governor in that case is admitted by the foreign state to be an official act, well, then immunity might apply. What we're talking about in all of these cases, to the extent agency matters, is avowed agents. That is, the foreign state says, these are our actions, which is exactly what happened in the Southern District of New York case, the Mariah case. Israel came in and said, this guy who was our former official is still kind of acting, doing black ops for us on the side. They put in an affidavit to that effect. These are avowed agents. That's point one. I don't have to win on that point to win this case, though, because even if you assume agency, what the United States said in USEF is that residency, it matters. That is, even if you assume a foreign official who was acting within the scope of their official capacity, because a foreign official in USEF v. Samatar had moved to the United States and was resident in the United States at the time of the suit, the United States said a major principle in not extending immunity to that foreign official is that they are a resident of the United States.
And here that's kind of essentially reciprocity. They're subject to our law. They benefit from our law.
It's a principle of U.S. sovereignty, right? That's what the United States said is, we recognize as an international law principle in USEF that the immunity of the official exists for the benefit of the state. We recognize that. Nonetheless, and that's the key word in the USEF statement of amicus, nonetheless, where there is a binding tie to the United States for the particular defendant, that is where they're resident, that the United States says there's no immunity. Now, Mr. Overmyer says, yeah, but there was no established government there. And that was the other principle on which the non-immunity determination rested in that case. Well, if you look at the subsequent history of that case, as we lay out in our brief, when there was a recognized government and the United States met with that government and that government said, we're not going to assert immunity, the U.S. said, well, residence then matters. We still stand by our original non-immunity determination. So this case really is on all fours. That is, while there was, it's not a case of, It's not a case of a government that doesn't exist, but we have a government that's standing on the sidelines. Government who hasn't gone to the State Department, hasn't asked for immunity, and we have U.S. residents who are claiming immunity on their behalf. That principle alone we win on.
So, Mr. Coffin, I do want your help just circling back in light of your argument to the appellate jurisdiction question. On the one hand, just because or if a court's going to find that there is no immunity, that is separate from, that doesn't defeat jurisdiction. I mean, we know that from Arbaugh and a whole line of-
And I'll take that. I'll take that, Judge.
I understand, but we're trying to get it right. I mean, that's our job. And so in some sense, it seems like the first case presenting a particular kind of fact scenario, like a non-official, non-employee, non-avowed or claimed private contractor, it seems like, well, there's an immunity issue bound up in there because there's an immunity claim. And then it seems like after, if we were to so hold, then it would become clear there is no immunity there, therefore no, you know, leg up to the Court of Appeals for purposes of a collateral order appeal. But that seems like that can't be right, that the first impression aspect of the question can't be the ticket to the Court of Appeals that then is used up.
Well, I guess the question is how Congress, I mean, there's a separate question that Judge Katz has asked in the API case, is how colorable is the claim? Now, if you
the
get
PS19, you're talking about the Nigeria case?
Yeah, the Nigeria case. It's last year's case. Yeah. APNI, I believe. Attorney, something process.
PUNI. PSID, Process and Industrial Development Corporation.
There you go. Thank you.
Yeah.
There's a separate inquiry of colorability. We actually don't think these are colorable claims given the lack of Qatar's involvement here. And that layers on top of the collateral order analysis, and we think we could win on that. But if you say, well, it's debatable, it's colorable, we still think that the nature of an assertion, the nature of an assertion by a mere agent of a foreign sovereign who has nothing but a contractual relationship with the foreign country just doesn't rise to the level of a substantial public interest, which I see not your favorite argument, but that's our position. Yeah, and again,
they do have allegations of direction by Qatar, but.
Well, no, Your Honor, let me speak to that for a second. We have not alleged, what we have alleged is that, and this is, I think we've alleged very clearly, we have alleged that Mr. Muzzin identified Elliot Broidy as a problem that needed to be dealt with. These defendants were deciding which packets of information went to which newspapers. That's our allegation. The direction, we have not alleged direction by Qatar. We've alleged that this stuff has been done on behalf of and in complicity with Qatar, but we've alleged that these guys have had an enormous amount of discretion into how to carry out this plan. You know, go after Elliot Broidy, if that's a direction, okay, maybe, but even there, it was Mr. Muzzin that said, we have to go after Elliot Broidy. So factually speaking, I don't buy into the notion that our complaint alleged direction. Yes, it did allege that these guys were FARA agents. It alleged that they acted, in complicity. Yeah, yeah.
Excuse me. Excuse me. Yeah. I want your comment, and I'll ask Mr. Obermeier the same question. To this statement, as a general rule, that is for non-official, non-foreign government officials claiming to be agents of the foreign government, that a necessary, although not necessarily conclusive, requirement for any assertion of immunity is that the foreign government communicates to the State Department that it's invoking on behalf of these individuals its immunity?
Your Honor, I mean, that's a predicate to our position. I mean, I think that's absolutely correct. Absent Cutter's avowal, absent Cutter's ownership of these assets, I mean, yes, they were FARA agents.
And the reason I formulate it that way is that one of the things that we're trying to do, and this argument back and forth really reflects it, is to see what impact either giving immunity or not giving immunity would have on the foreign relations of the United States with the country at issue. And you really can't know that. I mean, we're just guessing, and we're trying to make up some rule of law that weeds out the cases that don't have an impact from the cases that do. But the easiest way to do that is just make it a prerequisite that the foreign government has to communicate to the State Department on behalf of the individuals. And if the government doesn't, they don't get immunity.
So when Your Honor, when there is, I agree with that. What state has said is when there are officials, okay, when there is someone who's the president or defense minister, state will apply a presumption that their acts are official, and then they'll try to confirm it. But you
exactly
can't do that.
That's why I framed up in terms of non official foreign officials. We're talking not
that's
about
the key officials. Distinction between officials and agents here is you can't do that absent avowal by the foreign
right.
government.
My only hesitation, I'd like your response to what if Mr. Obermeyer's clients had a contract that said in terms, you know, we believe that in this activity, you're acting as our agents, including for purposes of any immunity that might be claimed. And, you know, I mean, for example, then the government changes and wants to disavow what the prior government did, would seem like there would still at least be a question whether they were pari materia with employees of a former regime that were treated presumptively as acting on the state's behalf.
And of course, you know, this is a counterfactual hypothetical because you yourself have said that the agreement said just the opposite. But you're suggesting, well, there might be some objective evidence outside the state. But I think for the reason that Judge Randolph is suggesting, you just can't know what the foreign affairs implication is when the state isn't stepping up. But again, under either standard, whether it's you have to go to state or you have to look for objective evidence outside, you know, outside of just the use of the word agent in a complaint, you don't get there here. There is no avowal. These are black ops, right? I mean, what state is going to come into a court and say, yes, these guys were our hackers and they were, you know, they were doing all of this on our behalf. They want plausible deniability, but there's a price to that. And the United States judge understands that. I mean, the one thing I take issue with the Ninth Circuit on, or one of the many things I take issue with the Ninth Circuit on, despite the fact that, you know, two of the judges were my colleagues in the Justice Department, but despite the thing that I would that I would take issue with Judge Collins on in the Ninth Circuit is the notion that you know that there's going to be some major international implications to holding Cutter responsible. It certainly let's put Cutter out of the picture, but as to the agents, you know, absent avowal, there's just the state continues to maintain plausible deniability. And as to these covert operations, every state, including the United States, understands that if their operatives are caught in a foreign state, those operatives are basically on their own. I mean, the CIA does what it can behind the scenes to bring them, you know, to get them back. But the United States operates at its own risk in covert operations overseas.
Right.
And so the reciprocity is just not as compelling here.
Judge Walker, do you have any other questions? Judge Randolph?
None for me.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Coffin. We've gone way over time, and Mr. Obermeyer will give you a couple of extra minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will be brief. First of all, I want to just make clear something that I said earlier with respect to agents in response to a question of Judge Walker, and it's related to something that Mr. Coffin said. The complaint alleges that they are FARA agents, and the complaint also alleges that they had lawful contracts where they were doing lawful activities, and then it turned into something, well, whatever he says, I think is more sinister or something like that. So I just want to be clear, like with respect to FARA, we're talking about the conduct that was, the contract that was registered and going forward. So I want to be clear about that. That doesn't change anything though with respect to—
So let me ask about that, because I thought that your answer was clear when you gave it, but then I thought you maybe backed off of it a little bit later in response to some other questions. So maybe I can think of a more precise way to ask the question. With regard to the context of this case, are each of the four defendants, are you representing that each of the four defendants are agents of Qatar?
I guess the answer, Your Honor, I don't mean to be evasive, is it depends as to what. I mean, with respect to what was registered under FARA and the lobbying work they were doing, they were agents of Qatar. What has been alleged is that they were also agents in a hacking conspiracy. And that allegation of directions, and I can talk about Mr. Coffin's direction comment, that is distinct, but it still gets you to the same place.
I think the complaint alleges that at least some of the defendants were not registered under FARA for the entire time. Do you represent that for the entire time in question, each of the defendants were agents of Qatar?
Your Honor, I don't remember the specific timing of the FARA registrations for all of appellants. But I agree with you. The complaint mentioned something about that. I just don't know the specific dates.
But, I mean, regardless of whether anyone was registered under FARA or not, I'll give this one more shot. Do you represent that each of the defendants were agents of Qatar?
For purposes of the lawful actions they took, they are alleged to have been agents of Qatar to participate in a conspiracy to hack and distribute material.
That's going back to what's alleged in the complaint. With regard to the time period in question, with regard to the time period that's covered by the complaint, and without regard to whether they were registered under FARA or not, do you represent that each of the defendants was an agent of Qatar?
Yes, but what I'm trying to say, Your Honor, is just that I just wanted to be clear that I'm not saying that we agree with the allegations that they were agents. That's all I'm trying to get. I apologize if I'm being obtuse or too talkative about it.
I'm not asking you to admit that they did everything that's in the complaint, but I do think that it's hard for you to assert foreign sovereign immunity without representing as a necessary but not sufficient argument that with regard to the time period in question, each of the defendants were agents of Qatar.
I don't disagree with you, Your Honor. FARA sort of adds complications, and then I wanted to make sure, to your point, I was clear about what I was saying on behalf of my clients. That's all. But I don't disagree with what you said, Your Honor, on that point at all.
Okay. Thank you.
The next thing I wanted to
time, unless one of my colleagues has a question.
Well, I'd just like Mr. Obermeyer's comment on the statement of a legal principle that I asked Mr. Coffin about.
Well, Your Honor, I'm sure you won't be surprised that I disagree with the principle. And I disagree with it because, what Samantar says, the Supreme Court has said that, the statement of immunity is not the sine qua non of immunity, of foreign sovereign immunity.
Under the FISA, that's true. And as far as federal or foreign officials, that may be true, but we're not talking about either one of those categories of people. We're talking about people who are even more remote. In other words, contractual agents.
But Your Honor, that's where I disagree with you respectfully, because the established policy, the common law, is that it's not the status, it's not them as officials, it's that agents of the foreign sovereign are entitled for immunity for actions directed by the foreign sovereign. That goes back, I think Mr. Coffey mentioned it, case of St. Clair, It goes back to a Twigross, a UK decision that has been cited favorably by the State Department. And I just would...
What about Mr. Coffin's point that these aren't actions directed by the sovereign, even on the allegations of the complaint alone, which says you hired these people Qatar hired these people and they decided in their discretion how to carry out the general remit, and this precise means and the precise targeting was not the directive of Qatar?
Two things, Your Honor. First of all, I already read this, but this is from page 9 of their opposition to interlocutory appeal, where Brody says that he, quote, alleges that defendants acted at Qatar's direction, end quote. So
generally,
that's different.
He doesn't deny that. Generally acted at Qatar's direction.
But what's key for derivative immunity is that what he has alleged they were directed to do is what is the basis for the alleged liability. He says that he alleges that he directed them to disseminate materials.
All right, do some great press for me. I hope you find dirt. You know, discredit this guy. See you later. And if I did that to, you know, my intern, I'm a newspaper editor. I do that to my intern. You know, go find some, and the intern goes and commits criminal activity. Surely,
I don't disagree.
Doesn't run. I mean, that's a bad example because it's not a government or immunity example. But, you know, chief of police says to officer, you know, go do X and so. There's no defense of following orders there.
I don't think I disagree with anything you're saying, Your Honor. But what I'm saying here is that what's alleged to have been directed is the conduct that establishes liability. So in Butters, the conduct was don't hire the woman because she's a woman.
Right.
The claim was Title VII. That's the level of specificity.
Right.
Here, the specificity is disseminate hacked materials, that he decides to do it to the Wall Street Journal and not the Washington Post or whatever it is he alleges happened. That's besides the point, because what forms the basis of liability is the direction to conspire to hack and disseminate.
Other questions? No. Thank you very much, counsel. That was well and informatively argued. The case is submitted.